On the Empire Podcast this week, we rev our engines with James Mangold to talk about Le Mans 66.
Everyone's reaction to the movie is, oh, I know what this is. Just a two-hour car ad, with, and we know exactly how it's going to end. And I'm like, well, I couldn't give less of a shit about the cars, and it doesn't end like you think it does.
Yeah. And chat Santa with Paul Feig to mark the release of his new movie, Last Christmas.
I loved the script so much, and then I was like, oh, and the added bonus is, I think we can go live in London.
Yeah. All this and the usual movie news, reviews, and nonsense on the only movie podcast that has received a Sonic the Hedgehog style makeover and now looks 50% less horrifying. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and I'm once again stepping into the enormous clown shoes of Chris Hewitt, who was so unaccustomed to taking leave, which he did last week, that it actually made him ill. So I'm afraid he is now home with the Lurgy, and we wish him all the best for a speedy recovery. And in the meantime, the podcast is mine! All mine! sorry, I'm here. Hello.
Hi.
And I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our West Wing guru, a man who insists every single morning that young Ben bring him the finest muffins and bagels in all the land and calls every single vessel from which he drinks the cup of glory. It's James Dyer.
I am, in fact, drinking from the cup of glory. yes.
Hello,
it's funny, like my introductions have never, ever evolved from the West Wing.
No.
That's essentially...
do you want them to?
I mean, no. Although I will say, Helen, it's the keg of glory more than the cup of glory.
Oh my God. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, I'm drinking from the cup of glory, but I like to think Josh Lyman will always be drinking from the keg of glory.
Well, he is a lot better than you, so that tracks.
It's his inner frat boy.
We also have with us, you may have heard him in the background, Amon Warman, who's such an enormous fan of The Lion King that his day doesn't start until he's been to London Zoo, hoist a baby animal whatever into the air on top of a rock and waited until all the other animals bow. Didn't you know that? So it takes him hours sometimes.
This is true. Hello.
See, he doesn't even deny it. It must be true. Zookeepers, if you've been wondering what's going on, it's definitely that. So, yeah, so we're here at least. We don't have the Lurgy. Are we Lurgy-free?
I'm Lurgy-free.
I am also Lurgy-free.
Oh, this is good. Hurrah. Yeah. Okay. Well done, us, for clean living and washing our hands lots. Shall we have a question?
Sure. Let's do it, Helen.
Okay, so this comes from Carl Jackson, who's on Twitter at Carl from Wolves. And he asks, what other Christmas songs would you like to see turned into a film? So obviously this week sees the release of Last Christmas, which does feature Last Christmas by Wham and other music by George Michael and Wham. So what other Christmas songs do we want to see?
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Fairytale New York is already a film.
Right.
Isn't
it? Is it that story, though?
Oh, God, no. No. What do you mean? Is it a bit, you know, homophobic and what? I don't believe it is. No, I think the film is fine. I mean, it's not fine. It's terrible, but it's not homophobic that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Because the song's been cancelled. The film has not been cancelled. The film is just frowned upon.
That word in the song has been cancelled. Yeah. I feel like the song has not been cancelled.
It doesn't get played, though, anymore. Like, it doesn't get playlisted because there was a big hoo-ha last year, wasn't there?
So, well, I mean, that's... Yeah.
Cancelled.
Anywho...
What would I use? Okay, let me bring up a list of Christmas songs.
You work on that. I know Amon has an answer already, so I want to hear what you have to say.
I have two potential...
Oh, what?
Let's hear it.
Potential. So, one of them, Santa Baby... Eartha Kitt.
Oh, yes.
As a sequel to The Boss Baby.
No, I'm thinking this actually is a sequel to The Christmas Chronicles. Because what I'm imagining will happen is that at some point, early on in the film, Santa, Kurt Russell will be turned into a baby. Which means that...
Wait, what? Kurt Russell's turned... Because, like, Santa Baby and someone's trying to seduce sexy Santa Kurt Russell into giving them presents, I was super with you on. But super sexy Santa Kurt Russell turns into a baby?
Stay with me. It gets better. It gets better. So super sexy Santa Kurt Russell turns into a baby. And because of that, Goldie Hawn has Mrs. Santa has to step in to save Christmas.
Oh.
Really, it was just engineering to get... Because who doesn't want to see that? Goldie Hawn as Santa.
Want to see Goldie Hawn as Santa, but I feel like we are missing the whole potential of the song. Because apart from the name, I feel like it's not a very baby-centric song. Did you know, by the way, that that song has a sequel?
What?
There is a sequel called This Year's Santa
Teenager.
Baby. No, you're still acting like the song is about babies, guys. You need to get past the idea that the song is connected to babies. There's a sequel called This Year's Santa Baby, also by Eartha Kitt. And it basically, genuinely, you can look it up, is the story of how all the gifts she got the previous year turned out to be rubbish and she needs new replacements.
Right. Wow. The world's most entitled Christmas song.
No, but I mean, Santa Baby is a song where she's basically trying to seduce Santa into giving her an enormous amount of
seems
very
perfectly fair.
Rich presents. That is
it's always worked for me.
That is genuinely a film that I think somebody should make, and I would like to see it if they have, because I think that could be hilarious.
A lot like it could end up being a porn film, Helen.
No, I don't think it would have to. I think you just need a sort of, you need a kind of Marilyn Monroe 50s kind of vibe.
If
you
did Santa, it in a sort of, I've been a good girl this year. I just, nobody needs that image.
We need a sort of,
then you have a weird bad Santa crossover where Lorelai Gilmore is going, fuck me Santa, and I just don't need that in my brain.
I just feel like there's a way to do this. I feel like it's a Down with Love kind of Marilyn Monroe, Gentlemen for Blondes kind of thing that could sort of work. I'm not saying I've ironed out all the kinks yet.
Wow, no pun intended.
But I think it could work.
Okay.
So my second one, I'm still working out the particulars of, but once I sort of settle on this title, I'll Be Home for Christmas, Bing Crosby.
Okay.
So stay with me here.
Yep.
But I'm thinking this opens up on a former cop in prison, wrongfully convicted.
Whoa.
He's talking. Stay
Ooh,
with me.
It's a gritty
stay with me.
Christmas movie.
He's 1 month away from getting out of jail.
Oh.
He's talking to his family in one of those, you know, phone window things. He's promising that
he'll be home for Christmas.
He's going to be home for Christmas. He's talking to his wife. He's talking to his daughter, his 10-year-old daughter.
Oh.
He's going to be home for Christmas. 1 month later, the day he gets out is Christmas Eve.
Oh, it's the last minute.
And that is how the movie begins.
You're thinking too low. I think it should be a sequel to The Wages of Fear. And it's I'll Be Home for Christmas or bits of me will be smeared across the landscape. Like, it's that's the level you should be pitching this at.
Wow. That's full of the Christmas spirit there, James.
Well, let me think. What other?
I just want to say, if anybody's listening to this, any Hollywood producers, I demand 20%. 20%.
The little drummer boy, I'm thinking a Love Actually spin-off starring Thomas Brodie Sangster's character.
Right,
and it's him.
Okay,
but also, you'd have to CG youth him.
Absolutely,
but,
de-age
you know,
him. Yeah, sure.
We can de-age him. That's no problem. I think that could work. Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Well, that's almost certainly porn. O Come All Ye Faithful, probably so is that. Mary's Boy Child, a kind of cougar drama about a woman called Mary.
Absolutely
not. No, okay, moving on from that. Jingle Bell Rock. It's The Rock.
Yes.
Singing Jingle Bells.
Oh my God.
Yeah? Where do I sign?
I couldn't be more sold. But I have my own suggestion. One of my favourite Christmas songs, and I'm not kidding, is a song called Mele Kaliki Maka, which is a Hawaiian Christmas song.
Okay.
Which was recorded in the 50s. It is a standard. If you hear it, if you look it up, you will find it. It's kind of spelled like it sounds, Mele Kaliki Maka, and it is great. I don't have a plot to go with this, but I think it's important that I go to Hawaii for Christmas to research it. So, Hollywood producers, if you're listening, if you're not sure about giving Amon 20% of your next film, give me, I don't even need 20%. I just need the budget to go to Hawaii for Christmas and research my undoubtedly hit movie.
I'm saying, if we don't want to be constrained by songs and we're just pitching Christmas movies to Hollywood, I'm just saying, Christmas Has Fallen. Jerry Butler. It writes itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Who can we get to record the theme tune? Like Adele singing Christmas Has Fallen? Because then it would kind of work, right? I think she'd be up for it. I mean, Celine Dion did a Deadpool song, so.
Which is great, by the way.
It's a great song, yeah.
It's better than most Bond songs, honestly. It's good.
I feel like we're onto something here. I feel like some of these could be actual films. They probably are already.
Well, my one's almost certainly in development, so.
Weren't they making like three more?
Oh, yeah. Many, three other things at least are falling, and one of them has to be Christmas.
I mean, that's a terrifying concept.
I mean, London's fallen. Angels have already fallen. That sounds like a Christmas movie.
It does kind of sound like a Christmas.
So, you
it's
know,
a
watch.
Bit, it's a bit sort of It's a Wonderful Life, isn't it?
A little
Spoiler.
Bit. Yeah. It's a Wonderful Life too. Angel Has Fallen.
Colon, Dawn of Justice.
Dawn of Justice, yeah.
Somebody
indeed.
Frantically ringing a bell, trying to get all the angels back up. That's an It's a Wonderful
But also,
Life joke.
We don't need more Christmas movies because we
what?
Already have the perfect Christmas movie, which is, of course, Love Actually. And really, I feel that at that point, we can just retire.
Wow.
I thought you were going to say Die Hard there
You
for
didn't
a second.
Say Die Hard also. Yeah.
Well, that was mainly for your own personal benefit because I didn't want you to reach across the table and murder me.
Oh, my God. I have stated before, but I will say it again because it needs saying every year. I don't mind if you think that Die Hard is
you
a Christmas
You just hate the conversation.
Movie. I just don't think it's clever or original to point it out, okay? So just FYI.
Yeah.
And Love Actually is certainly a film that happens at Christmas that I mostly like. I think most people like bits of it. Everybody likes the Emma Thompson bit, don't they?
So. And the Bill Nighy bits.
And the Bill Nighy bits, okay. Yeah. Those are pretty, uncontroversial. The rest is a little bit more
I love every minute of it.
Patchy.
With the sole exception of the Chris Marshall weird. I mean, it's not even a plot line, is it? It's just a tiny bit at the end, but that's the only part of it that annoys me. I can even deal with the Keira Knightley, Andrew Lincoln thing, creepy as it is.
Oh, no. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
She could and did do better in that film.
See, my whole thing about that is not so much that he's a little bit Me Too-ish, but it's also that his friend entrusted him with photography at his wedding and he fucked it up.
Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? If you haven't seen Love Actually, we've just given you a whole load of spoilers, but yeah, it's been a few years. I feel like you should have seen it by now. Okay, so Hollywood, call us. We're waiting for your calls and ready and willing to make the greatest, I think, Christmas movies that have ever been made. In the meantime, while we wait for the phones to start ringing, I think it's time for an interview. And we have two great directors this week. But since we've just talked about Christmas, it seems only proper that we start with Paul Feig. He's the comedy genius behind Bridesmaids, behind Freaks and Geeks, Ghostbusters, Spy.
I want a sequel already. Yeah. Or spin-off. Jason Statham's character. I need more.
Spy is literally the best film he's ever done.
Yeah.
Spy is really a great film. Yeah. But this week, he brings us Last Christmas, which stars Emilia Clarke, yes, her from Game of Thrones, as a Christmas shop elf whose life is in, and I think it's fair to say, a complete toilet, like utter disarray, until that is she meets a very handsome man who's played by Henry Golding. And I went along to talk to Paul Feig and find out more about the film. Now, full disclosure, I forgot to press record until halfway through our first question, so there aren't any friendly greetings at the beginning of this. There were. They just got slightly.
Does it just begin with you apologising? Like my Nicole Kidman interview from last year.
I just quietly, you know, we just did it just before the first question, but I didn't actually.
Oh, you didn't tell him that you'd fucked it up?
No.
Oh, see, I owned it completely. I went, Nicole, I've got to be honest with you. I'm not recording this. Can we start again?
I've got to be honest with you. I'm an idiot.
Yes.
No, so anyway, apologies for that. But trust me, he was a very pleasant man. There were pleasantries. I just didn't record them. And here is the first question. Enjoy. So Emma Thompson came to you with this film. Is that right?
Yeah. She just dropped into my inbox about a year and a half ago, because we were supposed to, I was supposed to direct the movie Late Night with her.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we got together a few times and kind of to talk about the character and just really hit it off. Major league. Then when that didn't work out because of scheduling, we just stayed in contact and going like, what are we going to do? We love each other so much. We have to do something together. And then, this script shows up that I didn't know if she had just written it or whatever. And then, I find out that, it'd been 8 years in the making.
Yeah.
I mean, the minute I read it, I was like, I'm in. Like, where do I go?
Absolutely. I mean, if you can work with Emma Thompson, right?
Yeah. Gosh. Dame Emma Thompson. You kidding me? Yeah. And she wasn't even supposed to be in the movie. I mean, she, was, producing it and had written it. And, I always have the writers of my movies on the set with me all the time. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you'll be with me the whole time. And she wanted to be. And then I was suddenly going like, well, how am I going to explain to people that I had Emma Thompson on the set the entire time and she's not in the movie? So I was like, Emma, you got to play the mom. She's like, well, I thought about it, but I don't know if it's a good idea. And I was like, I'm telling you, you will be great and I'm not going to not let you be in the movie. And, she's spectacular in it.
What is about Emma Thompson kind of glamming herself down for Christmas movies? Like, because I feel like Love Actually as well, that's a lot less glamorous than she actually is.
That's what I love about, one of the many things I love about Emma is, there's no vanity that would hold her back from doing a great performance and being all about the character. And she's playing characters in these movies that happen to just, that is their thing. They're real life people who are having problems and sort of, that's the point they are in their life. And I think it's so great. But then you see like Late Night and she's all glammed up and gorgeous. So it's the mark of a great actress to just be able to lose themselves in the character so much that they don't really care how they present themselves. And I think that's wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. And she does look incredible in Late Night. My God, those suits.
Oh, my God. Yeah, exactly.
Everything. So tell me about the rest of the casting. Amelia, I think you'd met a while back, is that right?
Yeah, like 4 years ago I'd had a meeting with her just because she was in town when I was in LA, and I was a big fan from Game of Thrones and was kind of curious what she was all about, because I expected her to come in very serious and stoic, like Khaleesi, weirdly, like she's not an actress. And she was this wonderful, bubbly, funny person. I just couldn't get over how funny she was.
Yeah, you don't get that from Game of Thrones really at all.
No, I mean, she's, she's great in it, but she has to play so contained and stoic. And once I find out that somebody's funny, I become obsessed with wanting the world to know that they're funny. And so, I left that meeting going like, okay, I've got to get her in a comedy. And I was writing something at the time that I was trying to write her into, but I wasn't happy with the script itself. So, a couple of years later, 3 years later, when I read the script, it's like, this is the one, because she can be a great actress and have all these great emotional scenes, but she'll also be funny, do physical comedy.
And was it always London set, this one? It had to be London.
Yeah, which is one of the other things that drew me to it, because you know, I've been wanting to shoot a movie here forever, and my wife and I have been wanting to live here forever. And it's funny, because I was just about to sign on a movie that would shoot all in L.A., and I remember my wife going like, well, she goes, that's fun for you, but for me, it just means my life just continues on as normal, you know, because we do have fun. It's fun to make movies on location, even though, you know, the stress of making a movie is always wacky, but it's just nice being somewhere, you know, where somebody else is paying for it. and you know, when I read this, I loved the script so much. And then I was like, oh, and the added bonus is, I think we can go live in London.
Yeah. But tell me about Henry as well, because I think you had to kind of wait for Crazy Rich Asians to come out.
So yeah.
Were you worried about that being a success, or were you just like, that's going to be big?
No, I knew, because my wife had seen it. We were friendly with John Chu because, you know, when I did Simple Favor, I called John, you know, because I wanted to hire Henry just because I liked him. I saw his online reel of when he was a travel show host and thought he was so great, and called John like, is he real? And he's like, oh yeah, he's great. So because of that, we became friends with John, and my wife has always been obsessed with the Crazy Rich Asians books.
Yeah, they're great books.
Yeah, they're so great. And so he let her come to an early screening, and she came back for that going like, this movie's gonna be huge. She was just like on fire about this thing. So I was like, oh well, you know, because when I read the script, I was like, this is perfect for Henry, but nobody knows who he is yet. The studio didn't know who he was. You know, and I would bring him up and kind of like, hey, he's going to be in this. And they're like, yeah, okay, yeah, but let's try to get, you know, so-and-so and this other famous person. I'm like, yeah, okay. So it kind of bided my time until that opening weekend. And then fortunately went through the roof. I was like, hey, remember that guy, Henry, I talked about? They're like, oh, we love him. Cast him. I was like, okay, good. It worked out.
We've always been huge fans of his.
Yeah, exactly. My goodness. Well, how can you think we didn't like him?
There's also, and I'm not giving any spoilers away here, but there is also a scene in the movie where he does a little Sean Connery, James Bond impression. Now, have you included that specifically so you will look like a genius one day when he is cast as Bond?
I mean, all I can say is Henry Golding should be James Bond. It's nothing has been more clear in my head than when you see him, especially when he's in a tuxedo or whatever. No, that was just, it was a joke that was in the script already, and it just felt right. And but then, you know, we thought it'd be funny to have him try to do Sean Connery. And it's, you know, and then Greg Wise was on the set kind of coaching him how to do the accent. There's a very funny outtake that is on the DVD and Blu-ray of him trying to do a longer version of the line and just really falling apart. And it's very, very funny. But we kept it in.
Yeah, it's cute. He just about, it gives you an impression of Connery-ness.
Exactly.
Right?
There you go. It's right. Yeah. Henry's Connery via Henry.
Yeah, and there is a tiny shot of Greg Wise in the crowd.
Yeah, he's sitting next to Andrew Ridgely in the last scene.
Oh, I didn't spot that. It was too quick for me to notice. That's brilliant.
Yeah,
I have to look out for that one next time. Did you have any problems with that ice skating scene, though? Because, you know, can everyone ice skate?
Well, I mean, Amelia wasn't a great ice skater, but that was nice because it was all about her not being able to skate.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, you never want to get somebody out on the ice and have them kill themselves either. So
that would be a downer.
Yeah, but exactly. But she's, you know, she's so good at everything that she, you know, she used it to her advantage. And Henry is an amazing ice skater, which is so funny because I actually thought, oh, Amelia will be fine. I don't know if Henry can skate, you know, having grown up in Singapore. But then you go like, oh, well, he said, no, we did a lot of skating there. And then he lived, you know, he's obviously grew up in London too. Mm. So he was just used to skating, and I was just so surprised that he was kind of so good at it, because I'm a lousy ice skater, but I actually reconnected with it, and I was out on the ice with them the entire time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because, you know, we're doing so much stuff going around them with the cameras that I had to have my monitors, and so I was like skating around behind the camera trying not to kill myself. But it was fun to be out there with them. And, you know, also we had Ali Pally all to ourselves.
Oh, wow.
Which was magical. I mean, that's the greatest feeling in the world when you get something like that and just like, hey, we're here. I would just kept putting on my skates and going out there and skating around and inventing reasons why I had to be on the ice.
I've got to ask now, do you have to have like, Are there cameramen who have on their CV that they can ice skate? Is this a thing that some people have?
I don't know if they list it as one of their skills, but it's something you go like, oh, so-and-so can skate. What happens, them we pretty much put on a sled and then have our grip department with these spikes on their shoes going around. But then my DP, John Schwartzman, he could ice skate too. He was like a hockey player.
Oh, wow.
So he and I are out there like skating around and, you know, John always is there with like a bounce board kind of right off camera, kind of sending nice warm light and reflections up into the actor and actresses' mm-hmm. faces. So it's good. So he was, you know, it's very funny. There's footage, I think, on the DVD of us kind of all skating around while they're doing this lovely love scene and we're all trying not to kill ourselves.
This whole group of people around the edge
of the ice. It's literally like kind of a joke.
And it also explains, of course, why everyone looks so sort of dreamily perfect in every scene. You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, John Schwartzman's such a genius cinematographer because a lot of these outdoor scenes in London, he wasn't able to do much lighting on. Mm. Because when you shoot like on Regent Street or any of these populated areas, the rule is you have to be able to clear everything you have off the street in like a few minutes in case there's an emergency. Because, you know, it makes perfect sense. So you can't have all these big condors and all these, you know, lights all over the place. So John at first was like, I have to go out with my light meter and see if we can even do this movie because we'd had to shoot a lot of available lighting. But he came back so excited because he was out on Regent Street, you know, with just those Christmas lights up. He said, like, I think we can pull this off. I can bring in a few battery operated lights and just kind of augment with that. But I think that's why it looks so pretty because that natural light, all the colors come out then. You know, if you kind of overlight it, I feel like everything kind of gets kind of homogenized weirdly. And this gave it so much depth and color and warmth. I just love it. And I mean, that scene when they're in the Christmas shop.
Oh my God.
Decorating the trees and they're having that conversation. That entire scene is lit just by the lights on the trees.
Oh, wow.
So it gives it that almost kind of Kubrickian sort of glow.
Barry Lyndon via fairy
lights. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, these cameras, we shot them, these 8K Panavision cameras, and they're just amazing. I mean, they're so light sensitive, but also so beautiful. And we have one scene, when they're talking in the bedroom and the only take I had that I really liked of this one exchange they have was in a big wide shot. And I was like, no, I want to be in close on them. So we're like, well, it's 8K. Can we? And so we blew this frame up so big, like to turn this wide shot into this tight two shot. And you cannot tell.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Amazing. So I'm a big fan of 8K now.
Yeah. I do want to ask about that scene because you're one of the few directors who has come to London and shot a film here and not had people living in palaces they can't afford, which was impressive. That is a sort of Brixton, I think. Oh, no, that was a Brick Lane, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It was a Brick Lane. Yeah, which actually Henry used to live on in real life.
Good.
Yeah. He's lived on Tom Street. It was crazy. Yeah, I hate that whole thing of like everybody lives in beyond their means and but they're down on their luck with this enormous place. No, it was important to us to make sure that we kind of made this real, you know, because it's a story about like real people and also about how everybody's, you know, the melting pot that London is and all the things that people are going through and how you live and where you live and what happens to you in life. It's all part of that and part of the authenticity of who you are. And so I don't like to have any false beats, even though it's a movie that is, you know, it has almost a fairy tale-ish element to it. I just don't want the trappings to be fake. You know, I think the interactions can be kind of heightened or can be a little more dreamy or a little more, I don't know, you know, movie-ish than that. But I want the trappings to be real, at least for a movie like this.
Absolutely. And you do have the fairy tale side of things as well. I mean, and I do want to ask as well about the Christmas shop run by Michelle Yeoh's Santa. Mm-hmm. I want every single thing she wears in this film for a start. But I mean, Michelle Yeoh has not been cast in a lot of comedies in her career, I feel like. So why not? I mean,
well, that's the thing. But again, for me, it all comes from, that's why I always just like to meet people, you know, like I don't necessarily like auditioning people and, you know, big stars, you don't audition them anyway.
Sure.
But that's why I always just like, anytime I can like have a meeting with somebody, and not even a meeting, like a dinner or drinks or something, then you can really, I see who they are. And then I go like, oh, I want that person to be on the screen. I want to show the world. I want them to have their misconceptions that I had blown away the same way that I did, because I'm a huge Michelle Yeoh fan. I mean, I love, you know, I'm just a Hong Kong movie nut and all the martial arts and stuff. So we've watched her for years and years and years. And of course, I had a big crush on her on top of
that.
Yeah, she's so gorgeous. But then Henry, when we were shooting Simple Favor, one night he's like, hey, you know, Michelle's in town. I'm going to have dinner with her. You want to come? I was like, does Michelle Yeoh exist? You know, because it is like there's certain people just go like, well, they're not real.
No,
you know,
definitely not. No.
Yeah, and it's like I can have dinner with Michelle Yeoh, and I was really nervous too because it's like I didn't know what to expect. You know, maybe she's gonna punch me or something. I don't know. And I show up, and she's the most wonderful, warm person I think I've ever met. I couldn't get over it, and the minute we sat down together, I think we were like best friends in 30 seconds. It was like we just like connect with somebody. And we had so much fun, and then we just became obsessed with like, we got to work together. We have to do something together. But I kept going like, I want you to be funny though. I'm going to make you funny. She's like, I'm not funny. That's all she'll say. Like, I'm not funny. It's like, I hate to tell you, you are. And so when I put her in the movie, like, you know, even during it, she's like, I'm not funny. It's like, Michelle, stop saying that because look, you're getting laughs in this audience. So yeah, it was, you know, again, when I see that side of somebody and nobody else sees it, then I want to put it on screen.
And I actually very much appreciate her commitment to ridiculous Christmas decorations. Yeah. Because I am the person with the Christmas robot on the tree kind
there
of
you
thing,
go.
You know. It's
well, she, the funny thing about Michelle is she loves Christmas. She's obsessed with Christmas just the same way that Santa is. Yeah, so, and honestly, when she, you know, she was worried when I, you know, when she read the part that we were going to kind of be making fun of it and also kind of having her be somebody who has like a because we always, the store is always described as having so much like crap in it, you know, just like in bad taste kind of stuff. And she was really worried because she was like, I love Christmas and I also don't want to be portrayed as somebody who's like ripping off people. Yep. And he's like, no, I totally get that, Michelle. I don't want that either. We're going to have weird stuff and we're going to have beautiful stuff in there. And it's because those stores are that
way. Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And you just find out. You know, when you do something like this and you're doing set dressing or seeing the set dressing, there's so much, there's nothing that hasn't been made into a Christmas ornament. There's no noun in the English language that is not a Christmas ornament.
100%. Like, I sometimes buy things just because I've never seen them before, yeah, totally. But then I'll see 10 of them the next year because something everybody's making, like McDonald's fries Christmas ornaments.
Oh, yeah. Every food item is an ornament. Crocodiles with pom poms are ornaments.
I mean, sure. I don't have a crocodile with a pom pom.
I've got the one. I stole the one from the movie. So,
That's going to be my next thing I need to get, definitely. And what are you working on next? I heard rumors about a monster movie. Is that
yeah, fun? Yeah. I've already written my first draft of it, and I'm really excited about it. Yeah, it's for Universal where my deal is. You know, so they've got this old, the classic monster catalog. And yeah, so I wrote this thing that I'm very excited about, kind of based on, there's a couple of side characters from some of the movies that I'm bringing into the actual thing, but then creating characters around them or out of them,
right?
If you will, and so I'm not talking about who they are yet, but it's I'm very excited about it because I'm such a fan of like James Whale, those older like the Todd Browning movies, which they were scary, but they had a good sense of humor about themselves, but they were not parodies, you know. So this isn't Young Frankenstein, which is brilliant. This is more. You know, I mean, Bride of Frankenstein to me is just the touchstone. It's just it's such a weird, great movie that has like comedy beats in it and weird stuff and these extreme characters, but then it's scary. That's what I want to do. I want to bring that back.
That'd be amazing. And are you talking sort of period set or kind of modern day?
There's a whole thing going on with this movie.
Well, as someone who also has a Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster Christmas ornament.
Oh, nice.
I approve. Sounds amazing.
I'm very
that sounds
thrilled.
Really good.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Well, listen, best of luck with the film. Can't wait to see it again, quite frankly, which I'm definitely going to do because it's a Christmas movie and that's the whole point of them, right? You watch them over and over again.
Thank you, Helen. I appreciate that.
Well, which ones do you watch? Which ones do you go to?
It's a Wonderful Life. I have to. It can't be Christmas if I don't watch that. Love Actually is Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah.
And Die Hard.
Of course, the classics.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you very much.
All right, time for some movie news. So what has been happening this week?
There can only be one place to start this week, and it is McClunky.
Okay, so I haven't got Disney Plus. I haven't watched this yet, but I'm aware that there are new 4K versions of the Star Wars films on Disney Plus.
All of these things are true.
And Greedo says McClunky?
He did. So Disney Plus, finally, its long-awaited debut happened, although not in the UK, and indeed a handful of other territories, which we won't be getting them until next year. But in the US and elsewhere, Disney Plus launched. The Mandalorian arrived to mixed reviews, and the original Star Wars films, specifically episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and Rogue One, all appeared in 4K HDR Dolby Atmos, which a lot of those had never been released on. So Last Jedi and Solo have been released on UHD, but the others haven't. So that's a really big deal. Everyone was very excited. Mm-hmm. However,
there's always a however.
However, it turns out that George Lucas, bless his little tinkering socks, has still been fucking about with Star Wars. And he tinkered with it a little bit more before he sold Lucasfilm to Disney. Mm-hmm. So this was done quite a few years ago. It's done like 2014. And, or 2012 even, yeah. It could have been. It would have been 2012. So he sort of did it in like 2012, something like that. He's tweaked the Greedo scene again. And it's been sitting there waiting to be seen for those years. It has finally dropped. And we've now seen, and he has simply changed it one more time. So to give you some clarity on this, obviously.
So obviously.
Greedo.
Shot first.
No. Han shot first. Killed Greedo, and any court in the world would acquit him on account of preemptive self-defense. That's absolutely fine.
That's
He was about to be shot, and
thing.
He shot first. Helen.
As your
Helen,
lawyer.
Go away. Anyway, Han shot Greedo. It's all good. We're all happy with it. No one is blaming Han. George Lucas, however, did. So when he did the 1997 special editions, he tweaked it so that Greedo shot first.
Outrageous.
Then when the DVD came out in, I think, 2004, he changed it again so that Greedo still shoots first, but they're closer together. Mm-hmm. And then when the Blu-ray came out, they shoot at basically the same time and Han Solo does a little weird CG dodge thing, which looks fucking ridiculous.
No.
Now, in the 4K version, they shoot at basically the same time. Han still dodges. The scene is a little shorter, like a few frames are missing of Greedo falling. But now, before he pulls the trigger, Greedo, for reasons known only to himself, looks at Han and goes, McClunky. And that is his final word.
So is this, like, somebody said this is something in Huttese? Is that right?
I would argue that Greedo probably speaks Rhodian and not Huttese, but that's a whole other thing.
A mistake of the maker.
I mean, perhaps I'm wrong, but I just assume he's a Rhodian. Anyway, yes, apparently Sebulba says McClunky, and apparently it means something like you're about to meet your end or something. I don't know if that's true. I haven't bothered to look into it. But I can say that Greedo now goes, McClunky. And that was the word that launched a million memes this week.
Yes.
McClunky is now in every film. It is now in everything. You can't swing a cat on the internet without hitting a McClunky.
It was one of those weird things. Like, I get to the Twitter notifications popping up on my phone, and I see McClunky. I'm like, what is going on? I just ignore it. Then one after one, more McClunky. What is this McClunky? I need to find out what this is. And then I was there.
Yeah.
This is why, not kidding, turn off notifications. They'll only drive you mad.
But the best part of this, I like to think, is our very own Ben Travis.
Uh-huh.
Never one to let a McClunky lie. Called up Paul Blake, the actor who played Greedo, and got his take on McClunky Gate.
Oh my goodness.
And it turns out, and this is absolutely true, he found out about it because Bib Fortuna texted him and said, McClunky. And he was like, Bib, what are you doing? What the fuck does that mean? And Bib was like, check on the internet.
Does he call him Bib?
Probably not. Okay. But Bib Fortuna texted Greedo to tell him about McClunky. And for that alone, and indeed all the other many things he has to say about this, go to empireonline.com and read Ben's interview with Paul Blake about McClunky. It is glorious.
Amazing.
But yeah, this meme has made me laugh a lot. I'm actually wondering whether there are other small tweaks to be found in the films as well, because people have noticed that, and I understand why, because that seems to be messed around with more than any other. That's the first place you'd look. But I imagine there might be other subtle changes, because I remember when the first three films came out on Blu-ray, we reviewed them, but we mainly reviewed the extras because we didn't watch all the films because we thought, well, we've seen these films a million times. And therefore we missed No! Which is obviously that horrific insert that Lucas drops in at the end of Return of the Jedi when Vader picks up the Emperor and throws him down the shaft. He now uses the same No! That you hear in Revenge of the Sith.
Oh boy.
And that, again, is horrific.
Oh, yeah.
George, we need to talk. Please stop. Please.
Yes, but actually what you want is from not to stop. You want 4K versions, let's be honest, of the original cuts.
You do. And you've got to think that now that Disney own Fox and they could legally do this, they're clearly going to, because it's surely a license to print money.
Got a license to print.
Well, exactly. No, I mean, you can, like, people have on the internet have acquired the 35mm prints and have scanned them in. I think there are a couple of different people who have done really painstaking restorations of the original prints and released those, shall we say, illicitly in 4K. So they are available. But other than that, the only official way to get the unedited ones is via a DVD release, which was a limited DVD run that ran, I want to say 2006, but they came bundled with the original versions.
Okay.
But in classic George Lucas style, Carl, it was a big fuck you to fans because he deliberately included them. They're not in 5.1, they're in like stereo or surround, and they're not cleaned up at all. They're letterbox. I mean, they're really grainy. And it was his way of saying, hey, you want the originals? This is what they look like.
Isn't there a Laserdisc somewhere?
There is a Laserdisc version as well, but then, I mean,
yeah,
who owns a Laserdisc player?
I'm betting they'll do that when The Rise of Skywalker comes out on Blu-ray and they'd have the whole set.
I wonder whether they'll want to release the 4K special editions as they are and milk that. And then once people have bought those, maybe they'll think, oh, there's one thing left to do. Let's do this. Who knows? Mm. You know, then do people even buy physical media to an extent that it would be worth their while to do that? I don't know.
I feel like there's a generation of Star Wars fans who might.
So. I'd fucking buy it. I can tell you that. Yeah. So.
Or if Disney Plus subscriptions start dropping off, this is another
maybe,
thing.
Although, did you see the numbers?
No.
So they released the numbers for Disney Plus, and I don't have it in front of me, and I can't remember, but it was something ridiculous, like 9 million subscribers on day one. So it is a pretty...
The servers had to crash for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, they did, yeah. They had a bit of a thorny first day. I think the only down note for them, because McClunky is all good for them, like it's fun for them, but I think the Mandalorian's reviews have been quite scathing, so I don't know whether that bodes particularly well. But then I think I've read a couple of reviews who've said that it picks up after episode one, so episodes two and three apparently are pretty good.
You're
but the response to one was not
reviews.
Great.
I haven't seen obviously. Yeah. I'm trying to go cold turkey and just
until the end of March. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to just ignore and mute and all that sort of stuff.
Good
so.
Luck with that.
Yeah, I know.
There are already gifs circulating of the final scene of the episode, so you can't really avoid that.
Gosh.
But
just
yes.
Head in the sand for now.
For those of us in the UK, 31st. Of March.
I mean, it's just rude, isn't it? Yes. I understand it's business necessary,
it is.
But it's still rude.
It is.
I mentioned it at the top of the episode, but there is a better Sonic trailer. Are we happier?
Yes.
We are.
We are.
He no longer looks like nightmare fodder.
Mm.
I mean, it was horrifying the first time.
It was
around.
Horrifying.
He was.
Yeah.
It was. I mean, I don't know if it's quite uncanny valley, but it's definitely uncanny. Like
yeah.
he had human hands and weird, sexy legs, and it was just. And his face was no. And now he looks like the game character, which is, I think, a good move.
Not to mention that trailer was soundtracked by Gangster's Paradise for some reason.
What's Coolio got to do with Sonic the Hedgehog?
I have. No
I mean, what
idea.
Does Coolio have to do with Dangerous Minds? Because it didn't really fit that film either. But, you
That's
know,
a very
here
good
we
point.
Are.
But we should. Give a shout out to Tyson Heath, who is the guy who led the visual effects team who came in and did all of this. It was really, really impressive. And honestly, in addition to Sonic looking better, Jim Carrey looks like he's having a lot of fun.
He does, yeah. That was
so
kind of intriguing.
I'm excited to see that
trailer.
As well. James is not excited to see
good.
That.
We like Jim Carrey. When he's on form, he's great.
Are you getting Batman Forever vibes?
Oh, boy.
No,
that's a good thing. Batman Forever is a good thing.
Yeah, he was fun in Batman Forever. I've got time for a limited amount of time for Batman Forever.
Yeah.
Hold me through and we kiss me, kill me. But not so much this. Like, I enjoy a blue speedy hedgehog as much as the next person. Mm. But Carrey in particular on this feels like he is firing on the absurdity cylinder, which I do not appreciate.
Yes, you don't like that kind of comedy,
so,
do you?
No.
Or the other kind of comedy, or the third kind of comedy, but you're willing to sometimes allow the fourth kind of comedy, but only in limited
my comedy tastes are quite specific.
We had a very long conversation this week about why you'd dismiss Parks and Rec as being the comedy of embarrassment, like The Office, and I had to explain at some length it isn't that. And you should
That's true, so maybe I should give that a chance, because I always thought it was Fremdscham comedy.
Wow.
Which is the type of comedy I truly, truly cannot sit through.
Parts and Wreckers on my list. I have not watched it yet.
What?
I know.
Both
I know.
Of you get out. I'll do the podcast on my own.
I still got Succession and other stuff like that to watch. And yeah.
No, but Parks and Rec is comforting and joyous and just the pick-me-up you need after Succession. So it's perfect.
Okay.
Also, in slightly painful news, the Joker movie has now passed $1 billion at the box office. So that's a thing that's happened.
Wow.
You know. What are you going to do?
Helen's enjoyment of that film, shall we say, was limited. But
there was enjoyment.
I'm quite surprised that it's done that well. I mean, I'm not surprised in that anything attached to Batman is obviously going to attract a certain amount of attention.
And
but
I think it's been very successfully marketed as the comic book film for people who think they're above comic book films. Mm. And I think that has worked enormously well for them and obviously continues to do so. It is still, for the record, a comic book movie. You're all children, just like us Marvel fans. It just has the trappings of intellectuality that you so crave.
Do you think it's the comic book movie that Martin Scorsese would approve of. Essentially,
well,
that's
he
what
literally
saying.
Does. Yeah. He literally produced it.
So,
if I were a cynical person, I'd say that, you know, the current discussion fed into that $1 billion box office quite well. Yeah. I don't think he's that cynical. I don't think he is. But, geez, it didn't hurt that film's box office.
No, no, it didn't.
Which comic book success story is more surprising to you, Joker or Venom?
Venom is inexplicable.
Yeah.
Absolutely inexplicable. It is an objectively terrible film, and everyone went to see it. I can only assume they left morose, disappointed, and
cheated. Much like leaving the Joker.
Indeed. But they did go and see it. And I was like, but they saw the trailers, right? Like, it looked terrible in the trailers. Yeah. It looked like what it is in the trailers. And yet, people liked it.
I am a loser too, Eddie.
Fuck off.
With all that being said, I am intrigued about Venom 2 and Andy Serkis.
Well, Andy Serkis, yeah. Mm. Andy Serkis, yeah. In Serkis we trust. I weirdly think that Venom 2 might ultimately be a decent film.
Mm. Well, when they had fun with Venom, there was potential there. You could see something that could work, the kind of more absurd moments. I'm sorry, James, but they were. The more absurd moments actually worked really well. And so maybe if they kind of lean into that in the sequel, then they could be really onto something.
Just have Eminem back on the soundtrack.
Also, you can explain to me the importance of Mark Wahlberg apparently joining Uncharted. Wasn't he at one point going to play Nathan Drake, and now he's playing like...
He's Sully now, isn't he?
Okay, he's like a mentor.
Sully's his elderly mentor.
Elderly.
So he's you know, he's not a spring chicken. It seems like a slightly... But then this is young Nathan Drake, so I guess it makes sense.
And in fairness, Tom Holland, not that one, the other one, is a spring chicken. So
I mean, I guess it works in that regard. Mm. But again, I'm not... Honestly, and ultimately what it comes down to is I'm not on board for any Uncharted film that doesn't feature Nathan Fillion as Nathan Drake. And ultimately, I will not be moved from that position. So much as I love Tom Holland, I'm not there for this.
Oh my
Did you watch the YouTube fan film?
Yes, it's amazing and really I love good. It. And they should stretch that over an hour and a half and release it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Honestly, I won't
That's John Voight as Sully, as I recall in that.
Yeah, yeah. I won't believe this movie is getting made until I, you know, read the press release that, you know, day one of filming has started. Because how many different iterations has this gone through?
Well, I feel like Mark Wahlberg was connected for actually quite a long time at one point, so... You know,
I should also say, like, while we're talking about video games, someone needs to make the movie of Death Stranding. Do you remember? So this is the new game.
I thought Death Stranding was the movie of Death Stranding.
I mean, it is a little bit. So this came out, I guess when this goes out, it'll be last week, won't it? So this is a game where it's a Deliveroo simulator, which features Guillermo del Toro, who randomly turns up, a character called Die Hardman, and then Edgar Wright, who pops up for no reason to give you a parcel to deliver.
And also him from Walking Dead.
Yes, and also has Norman Reedus, who drinks a lot of Monster Energy drinks. It is absolutely batshit in a level I don't think I've ever encountered in a game before.
I like my video games, but I've read and watched a few reviews of this game, and it seems like you're walking from A to B a lot. And that, to me, is very boring to play.
It is literally Deliveroo. You have the Deliveroo pack was kind of on your back, and the whole mechanics of the game are, can you deliver these boxes from A to B without falling over?
I can't see myself enjoying it. I've watched reviews and I've seen a lot of positive, you know, stuff on social media, but I'm just like, no.
I know, but I feel like when Guillermo del Toro asks you to deliver a box to someone on the other side of a mountain, you just do it.
Aren't you going to ask, what's in the box? What's in the box?
A little bit.
I would be worried, that's all I'm saying.
I want to see this film. Make it happen.
Also in news this week, Paul Thomas Anderson has announced that his next film will be a 1970s high school movie. I heard this and I just started having flashbacks to like Richard Linklater sort of dazed and confused kind of movies. But Paul Thomas Anderson making a new movie is, well, actually the two are synonymous. A good new movie from Paul Thomas Anderson is always good news. So I'm still here for it. I'm just like, what? Why 70s? Don't know.
We will find out.
We will.
Mm, very good news. Also, The Little Mermaid has found her Prince Eric. It will be Jonah Hauer King, who you will, of course, remember from Little Women. Not that one. The TV one from a couple of Christmases ago. So the one who isn't Timothée Chalamet, but who also played, as I remember, Laurie in that film. I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest, that he's handsome enough to play Prince Eric. I'm not sure, however, who in the world is handsome enough to play Prince Eric. So I'm willing to allow him. He seems like a nice young actor.
Fair enough. Yeah. Kevin Feige's been saying things this week.
Mm. Oh no, please tell me it's not about anything.
Well, he did respond to the Martin Scorsese thing, though very diplomatically, I thought, in a kind of like, well, everyone has a different view of art and look at what we've done. We pit our characters against each other in Civil War. Fucking hell, we killed half of them in Infinity War.
I mean, yes.
So, and I think these are all solid points. But more importantly, he made a comment about Disney Plus, which incensed a lot of people, which was that you will not understand the full story of the MCU unless you watch the Disney Plus shows.
I mean, that's been obvious for a little while, yeah. Actually.
I feel for some of them, like I wonder whether like WandaVision feels like something that will be a nice diversion, but I don't know that that's necessary, unless it tees up your Multiverse of Madness, but I feel like it's...
Well, I think it does, though.
I mean...
Or ties into it, at the very least.
This feels a lot like when people were like, oh, you know, if you don't watch Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you won't. And it's like, that's not really true, though, is it?
But that's because they were always actually on different schedules.
That is
true. And
that
was more wishful thinking on our part than anything else. Because there was just, it was never possible to plan those shows around the Marvel movies. That was why the events of Captain America, the Winter Soldier, came as such an unwelcome surprise to the showrunners.
But again,
immediately. But they dealt with it very well. But there was no way that they were going to be able to kind of lead on that. So... you might have something like that where things happen in the movies that then have repercussions in these shows. I don't know how much there will be going the other way because you still have to make the movies work on
and
their
even
own.
Though he said this, and it makes sense for him to say this because he's trying to feed the beast and he wants people to subscribe to Disney Plus. But I would be, it would fundamentally be bad filmmaking if you made films that didn't make sense without having watched a TV show first. And I don't believe for one second he would entertain that. Will you get perhaps a deeper understanding of background knowledge from having watched it? Sure, why not? But I don't think it's going to affect anyone's
will that
enjoyment.
One character have had lots more backstory that will add meaning to that
absolutely.
Line 100%
yeah but I don't in the same way that you get more out of for example watching Solo if you've seen Rebels and Clone Wars because you understand the sort of Maul legs thing his evolution as a character yes that adds more to it do you need to have seen it no of course you don't
yeah
and I think that's very much the case here but that didn't stop the internet from burning Feige in effigy for trying to make them Disney Plus
it must be a day ending and why speaking of burning people in effigy just before we finish up, Blumhouse is making a new Black Christmas and announced this week that it would be a PG-13, which had people incensed because, oh my God, every horror movie must be an R.
Because the internet.
Because the internet. And actually, the filmmakers have kind of come back and gone, no, this played really well with sort of teenage girls, quite frankly, and we want them in our audience. We welcome them into our audience. Why wouldn't you want them to have an introduction into horror, you idiots? They didn't say that last bit. I'm kind of freewheeling there, but I feel like that sentiment was underlying it. So that's happening, and apparently the word from those test screenings is good, but I don't know for sure, so we shall see soon. So I think that's most of it. Anything else for news for you guys?
I was just going to say, while we're talking about MCU, some Disney Plus artwork and clips have been released online, showing little bits and pieces from What If, and also showing the new redesigns for Bucky and Falcon's cap costume, which I like Falcon's cap costume, but I actually prefer his comic book cap costume to it.
This isn't really cap. This seemed to be like somewhere halfway in the middle, right?
This is the costume, at least in the concept art that we've seen, is closer to the animated series than the comic book cap costume. Earth's Mightiest Heroes, Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes is a really, really good cartoon, by the way, check out. So I enjoyed it, but yeah, I check out Falcon's comic book cap costume is much better. And Bucky, we are lamenting the loss of his hair.
R.I.P. long hair, yeah. He's gone back to the sort of World War II cut.
Although, in the animated What If little clip that we've seen, he's got his hair back. He's fighting zombie Cap.
You can do that with animation.
Yeah. You can do that with animation. And also, I mean, I've had this discussion with Amon before. Yeah. I have an objection to Marvel zombies, almost entirely because they made Wolverine a zombie, which I don't think fits his healing factor. No. Genuinely, that's my principal objection to the entire
He'd be
of
an
comics.
Unstoppable zombie because he has an adamantium skull, so you couldn't shoot him in the head.
It's true.
How about through the eyeball?
Maybe through the eyeball.
Okay. Glad I could help.
So I have a question about Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Okay.
So you're the Falcon, right? And Cap comes up to you and says, it's time, and gives you a shield. And you're like, dude, I've got fucking wings. What the hell am I going to do with this? Like, he has no super strength. And I feel like Captain America works with let's be honest, a shield is an accessory. He works because he's a super soldier. You give, you know, Falcon a shield and he's just a dude with a shield. The man has wings.
An
like, what? He's downgrading
shield.
to hold a shield.
He's not. He still has shield, the wings. Yeah. He can use the wings.
He flies.
While, he can use the shield while he's airborne.
He's not going to, though, is
and
he?
The shield totally doesn't.
I will take that bet.
The shield totally doesn't obey the laws of gravity. Like, we know that. So,
yeah, but
you
I
know,
like to think a lot of that is because Cap's super strong. I think, you know, you give it to Falcon, he's A, not going to be able to lift it. It's probably too heavy for him.
Oh my goodness. In the end of Endgame, what are you talking
so
about?
So negative are you.
I'm not feeling it.
Anyway, adamantium isn't heavy. It's like mithril.
I think you'll find it's vibranium, Helen.
Sorry. Vibranium isn't heavy anyway. I think you'll find it's like mithril.
Okay. Sure.
See, that was a geeky level of geekiness, whole thing. By the way, the Russos are making a film about the rivalry between Marvel and DC, but it's a documentary.
Yeah, so, I saw that.
Yeah, that should be interesting. Mm. I mean, there might be accusations of bias. Yeah,
is this an objective look?
I'm sure they will be objective, and I'm sure they will have great people from both sides.
Yeah, very fine people on both sides.
Very fine people from both sides. I think it's time for another interview, and we have a real treat for you. The director of Le Mans 66, if you're in this country, or if you're in America, the director of Ford versus Ferrari,
which
James
is a
Mangold.
Better title.
Yep.
It is a better title. Apparently it was quite hard to clear with legal on this side of the pond.
What?
Is James Mangold. So he has had an incredibly eclectic career so far, making the likes of Girl Interrupted, Kate and Leopold, seriously, Logan, of course,
amazing
310 to Yuma. He's basically done every genre going. And so it was perhaps only natural that he would come to the genre of films about men in room talking about cars that you don't have to like car racing to like. So myself and Chris went along to talk to him in London recently and find out more about Le Mans 66. So James Mangold, welcome to the Empire podcast. Thank you for coming in.
Great to be here.
With Le Mans 66 or Ford versus Ferrari, do you have strong feelings on the title of the US versus the UK?
This was one of those movies where, in a way, it's the most unfortunate thing is we never landed on a title while we're shooting it. And so then it becomes a bit of a free-for-all upon release with each territory. You know, the biggest problem you have is that, well, one of the reasons I think it traumatizes the British press so much is that usually the UK title and the USA title are the same.
Yeah. Easy.
But all the other territories, I've never had a movie where, like, Girl Interrupted isn't called Girl Interrupted in France.
True.
It's called Le Blah 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 Silence. Or in Spain, not the same. In Brazil, different. In Greece, different. In China, certainly different. So the real trauma is just why two titles in English-speaking territories? And the only answer I can offer you is it's a group of factors. One is that apparently Ford v. Ferrari is not something we could call it in the UK because of trademark. Press laws are different than there, where you're not allowed to use a trademark that the company who owns it hasn't given you permission to use in a title. Mm. And so clearly, I mean, I think ultimately Ford will get good things out of this movie, as will Ferrari, but I don't think either company was in a position when I wouldn't even show them the movie yet to give us a pass
to
on
sort
using
of sign
their trademark.
Off on it.
Yeah. Beyond that, I think there's also, through much of Europe, a feeling that everyone knows Le Mans. And in USA, I think 1 out of 20 people would know what Le Mans is. So there's that going on as well.
The educational factor.
Yeah.
As well. Also, once you call a film Le Mans, you have the film Le Mans to deal with as well. So is that why there's 66 in the title?
Well, certainly I don't think we could call it exactly the same thing. I wouldn't have wanted to. Although, if we're realists about it, how many, I mean, maybe your very specific audience, there's a hell of a lot of people aware of films like Le Mans or Grand Prix, but so many of our, right, yeah, okay. But the reality is, among the current cinema-going generation, those movies, were, you know, you're talking about 1 in 50 people who are aware.
Yeah. So, I mean, this film's been kind of on your radar, I think, since before The Wolverine. Is that
right?
That's right.
It was not only on my radar, but when I got the script to The Wolverine, which was right around the time Darren stepped off it, I was on a meeting at Fox trying to get them to let me make this movie.
Oh, wow.
But they were working on a different package with a director and different actors, and it was kind of locked up in that, and I was just a pirate trying to steal something. So it was made clear to me. I didn't know that, of course. I don't go normally flying in and trying to steal other directors' films. But I just read a script and said, what's happening with this? But the struggle with this film, I think, has always been the natural fear in our modern age that there's no one over 25 who goes to the movies anymore, and that it's an expensive proposition to make a film like this. And without you know, an IP, a character that is a known draw, or a kind of property that is a known draw to a very specific base of audience, you don't have a guaranteed return on your dollar. I mean, for many in your audience, the simple reality, studios, I wouldn't call them evil or good. They're just a kind of impassive in the sense that they have a very simple rule. I think William Goldman first put a finger on it, which is they assume your movie will be shit. and which is not unreasonable, because as directors and filmmakers, we don't bat a thousand. So if they're putting their money on the line, they assume you're going to make a mess. And if you make a mess,
can they still sell it?
Can they still sell a mess? And so with a superhero theme or a known character or an ongoing franchise, they can actually do the estimations of whether this film will be a success, even if it's shit. And that way, if I succeed at making a good one, it's just gravy. It's cherries. It's all the better. But, you know, if you get down to it, when you're buying a house and you inspect the house, your house inspector is wondering how the house is going to hold up in the rain, how the house will hold up if the land slides or there's a mudslide, or how much of a fire danger your house is. So clearly, even in our own lives, we buy things assuming that we can't think less of the studios for assuming the worst, because most of us in our decisions, if we are to survive in this modern world, don't make all our decisions out of romance. We make them out of some realism about what dark shit could happen.
We're trying to play it safe.
You're trying to play it. We're trying to survive.
So how do you kind of hedge for that? Is that part of getting like this amazing cast? Because this is, it's an embarrassment of riches.
Well, thank you. I am honored by all these actors who joined us, particularly not only in the leading roles, which you can imagine are really attractive, but even in the supporting roles, there's just a wealth of talent. And your question's like interesting, because on one level, it's not like you go, oh, well, my movie topic isn't much of a draw, so I need better than shit actors. You know, you don't, you are always trying to get an amazing cast.
Yeah, of course.
But the fact is that whatever it was about Jez and John Henry's script, the topic, the world, and I think what drew me to the material was never racing. I'm not a big racing guy. What drew me were there were great characters everywhere you looked, whether you're talking about Enzo Ferrari or Henry Ford II, who are much more interesting than on the surface, to certainly Ken Miles and Carroll Shelby, who are unique and, you know, dependent upon each other and really unforgettable characters, to all the creatures who inhabit the pit and the engineering world, and the way they're all interconnected and competing with one another, I think was really attractive to actors.
So let's say, for example, that pre-Wolverine, you had got the green light on this movie and you had snatched it away from that other director, Jim. It strikes me as well, you could have still made it with Christian Bale and Matt Damon.
You mean 8 years ago or something? Sure.
Yeah. Or did you have different actors in mind?
I at the time I was stalking it, I didn't even have actors in mind. I just had in mind trying to get my hands on it. Because I felt it possesses, I mean, this project kind of possesses everything I'd love to do in the current climate of film, which is, it seems to me, I love to work on the big screen. And as long as the world is letting me work on the big screen, I'm going to work on the big screen. It's a big screen story. It's a story that justifies the movie-going experience. Not only action, but also the style of the period, the look of that period, the recreation of this kind of innocent romantic moment in sports before the world was taken over by television and sponsorship. And when these characters were kind of mavericks, cowboys in a way, themselves, and there was a kind of magic to the way they were risking life and limb without computer models or risk-averse abilities to build these cars. You had to just put your lives on the line. All that was so bloody interesting to me. But what I was really trying to answer in your question was, what makes it the kind of movie I love to make is I miss these movies. Meaning I miss when the David Leans of the world were making pictures and there were movies that were for grown-ups, that were adult films with adult characters having real life problems, paying their taxes, holding their family together, staying afloat, fulfilling their dreams, and that the problems of the characters in the movie weren't oriented toward an audience of 13-year-olds. And that we've all gotten so used to it that we've actually kind of disconnected and connect. You know, when we watch movies, we kind of, I mean, I even think on the level of folks who do what you do, we all just put on our 13-year-old inner self hat and absorb the film through the prism of kind of our younger selves. And that, but I do think there's a hunger, and it's answered when you see certainly the success I felt with Logan, mm-hmm. or what we may see happening right now with Joker and other films. There's no reason we can't combine fantasies and ideas with adult themes, because that's what cinema has always done. It's just that the audience on a business model level has so shifted toward children that every film has to be kind of maintaining this foot in each door. I love to make films for a whole family. Mm-hmm. I love to make films accessible for everyone. But sometimes it would be nice to see an action picture that wasn't idiotic or that didn't build its characterizations on the head of a pin.
I do think that the characterization in this one was great, and the balance of action to character work and to, you know, men in rooms talking scenes, which I tend to love if they're smart men and get really bored.
Also, there's
not.
Things at stake. And even though it's talking or a kind of chamber piece, there's something at stake. I mean, everyone can't be watching The Crown or Fleabag or all the other amazing pieces we see on Netflix or HBO or otherwise. I mean, even Game of Thrones is mostly chamber pieces of brinksmanship between characters. So audiences clearly have a thirst for that. And those are adult pieces. I mean, Game of Thrones is an adult piece. Mm-hmm. So what's frustrating is that the theatrical movie experience has been somehow infantilized, however you'd say it, adolescentized, while the cable or television or streaming experience is aiming itself squarely at us 30-plus-year-olds who don't leave the home anymore. Yeah. So this gets me in a 12-minute roundabout way to making movies like this as an effort to kind of sustain the original film as a theatrical event, not just the small independent original film that may play for 3 weeks in an art cinema, but a movie for everyone. And when we use the word characterization, it sounds like some cod liver oil. It just means these are characters you like, who are interesting, who surprise you, and who have something new to say, you know?
And they do, like, continually throughout the film. I don't want to get into spoilers, but, you know, I did not see Ken Miles developing the way that he did. I did not see Carol Shelby developing
the
way that he did.
And thank you. That's the point. And in many ways, I saw in our run-up with the movie, before a lot of the press had seen it, everyone's reaction to the movie is, oh, I know what this is. Just a two-hour car ad, and we know exactly how it's going to end. And I'm like, well, I couldn't give less of a shit about the cars, and it doesn't end like you think it does. Yeah. So it's like this kind of, it's just, but plus, I'm always amazed. They never say that shit about Marvel movies, and it's absolutely true. So the reality is that everyone assumes the worst, assumes we'll lean into every trope, and everything will end up with every fanny getting patted in a way that is obvious or stereotypical. And I my whole attraction to this story was that from the moment I first read it almost 10 years ago, nothing turned out the way I thought it was.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, you know, far from being a car ad, you know, this points to some real problems in the corporate culture, essentially, of Ford in particular, Ferrari maybe to a lesser extent. And it felt like there was maybe a parallel there with the way that certain other big businesses that you may have had experience with.
Certainly. I identify hugely with these characters, and the struggle to make a car is not much different than the struggle to make a movie. You know, I'm not trying to level blame at anyone in particular. I don't think it's about blame. I think these are the forces of our world culture.
Yeah.
And this is in the mid-60s, it's this kind of turning point as corporate culture is taking over. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Ford manufactures cars for working people, affordable cars. Ferrari manufactures cars no one can afford, except the very rich or racers. So it's really the story of a battle between a kind of working class manufacturer trying to get the cool or acquire the cool of an aristocratic car manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And that to me in itself is interesting because it speaks so much to all of our quests. You know, I even find Ford's quest sympathetic in that they feel dumpy and dumped upon, but they're not even in the same realm as Ferrari. Ferrari isn't out to make money. In fact, he's going bankrupt. Mm. It's a Quixote-esque journey of just making the very best bloody thing he ever can. In fact, if anyone has similarity in the movie, it would be Ken Miles and Enzo are similar characters because it's kind of they don't care or think about tomorrow. They are just in pursuit of perfection.
Yeah.
And that's a really beautiful for me, an artistic metaphor, but also a kind of romantic sentiment that I wish more people had today.
Yeah,
no, absolutely. And by the way, Jim, I love the fact that you're saying "bloody" quite a lot. Is that do you adapt?
It's totally.
Your swear
I'm
words?
Like I'm like when the Clintons go to the South or the. It's I've been here a couple of days, so it just starts to eke in. I also found myself describing an apartment as a flat. So I've completely. Give me another 2 weeks. I'll start it with an accent.
Oh my
Everything
god!
Will be brilliant, anyway.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah. Fully anglicized. So when you're making
I'm
the
like
movie,
Madonna.
There's an image that I will knock it out of my head.
Well, we both direct pictures. That's, there you go.
This is true. This is very, very
it
true.
It goes that far. That's true. Yeah.
So throughout your career, you seem to you've always made left turns as a director. You know, you're the guy who directed Copland, but also Kate and Leopold. You're the guy who directed Night and Day, but also 3:10 to Yuma. None of Lewis films are the same. But do you see thematic similarities? Is this something that drives all those movies for you?
Yes. First of all, it doesn't have to be thematic. It's kind of my love. I'm making movies I want to see. And, you know, every time I jump on a movie, it's a 2, 3, 5 year experience developing it and making it. And I'm also trying to develop myself. You know, Billy Wilder went, he made one comedy or slightly comedic film in his first 16 and then is mostly known now as a comedic director. I've only made 10 films.
Yeah.
So Howard Hawks made westerns and comedies, and it's only a very newfangled situation that directors are so clearly branded as a teller of one kind of story or another. I don't think Sam Mendes should be reduced to only telling or making one kind of film.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I also think that I'm always in the quest for intimacy or a kind of naturalism or emotion. And I can only describe this is the universal thing for me, that if I'm making a romantic comedy, I want it to be one that's a little less, that honors all the classical movements, but is a little less of a product. That there's a little more of a handmade feel, a little more loopy, a little more personal. So for me, whether it's Copland or it's Kate and Leopold or it's 3:10 to Yuma or Girl Interrupted, this unites all of them together for me, that I'm always after this kind of the ultimate special effect, if you would, which is a human thought recorded.
Yeah.
And each film teaches me something for the next. And I think I suffered a little for this in my early years directing, because it's so much easier when guys like you two can put me in a box, because then it's also easier for me to get hired. You know, I become the master of rural cinema, or I become the new master of comedy, or I become the new master of horror, or I get anointed something, and then I get lots of offers and material and books come my way all along those lines. But when you're kind of a lifesaver variety pack, you as a creator, it makes it a lot harder for anyone to figure out what you are.
Yeah.
You don't end up on as many lists, because no one's making lists of all around utility players. They're making lists of the best in a certain category. But I feel like I've reaped the benefits later in my career now, where I can make any kind of movie next, meaning unlike some of my peers who are now kind of locked in a prison of the brand that they've built, I can make a musical, I can make a noir picture, I can make an intimate indie style movie, I can make a drama, I can make a war movie, and the doors aren't shut to me, because the groundwork, I've made enough successful pictures of different stripes that people have a confidence that I can handle whatever it is I choose to make. Can I say one more thing about
that? Of course you
can. You know, when I first started, like most directors starting out, you just want to be a great filmmaker, right? And that makes you tight, because it's like your every moment you're shooting has to be bloody great, has to be great. And you're trying. I'm also using bloody to replace fucking.
No, which that's really,
maybe am I okay
with
fucking?
Fine with
very
fucking.
Impressive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then I'll just do fucking. The you want everything to be fucking great, and it makes you tight. It makes you really, really tight on the set. Everything is so precious. You feel like your career hangs in the balance if you don't make your great opus. If this isn't as good as Fellini or Antonioni or you know John Ford, then you're washed up.
Yeah.
But it produces a kind of paralysis, at least for me, of stress. And when, after a first couple serious movies or movies where you had hopes of you know, going to Cannes like I did on Copland, or getting honored in different ways as my actors did on Girl Interrupted. You suddenly make a movie like Kate and Leopold and you know, well, there's no way I'm ever going to any awards show or being hailed in the Pantheon for this picture. And it produces this relaxation.
Yeah.
It's like Bruce Springsteen recording Nebraska on a cassette machine. You're just alone with your material. You don't have this stress. You don't feel like you're going to have to get over some limbo bar of perceived excellence. You just try and make the best movie you can. And after making Identity and Kate and Leopold, coming back to, quote, the serious Oscar-y picture with Walk the Line, I was really amazed how much more relaxed I was on set, how much more playful, what a better director I thought I was for having made movies with a lighter touch, where I learned how sometimes really good things can happen on set when I'm not squeezing the orange so hard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for the record, I would absolutely see a James Mangold musical. I think that would be amazing.
But, good.
I mean, according to IMDb,
We're working on them.
Well, you're linked to about eight different things, I think, at the moment. Can you tell us what's next? Do you know yet?
I can't.
Okay.
I can't, not only because I can't, but I can't because I don't know. I'm literally working on about eight different things, and I'm just seeing what happens to feel right for the next moment. All of them, I think, will happen. I think they're all really great. I mean, I'm in a great place, but it's about which script feels strongest, the right cast assembles, and feels right for the time. Mm-hmm. It's a really tricky time in movies, and I think that you need them to play or work for an audience to come out and see them. And I want to make sure we're offering something. I think things are going to get better, but I think it's really tough right now. So I'm trying to make sure we do things that also get seen.
Yeah.
Just very, very quickly, Jim. The Force, I love that book, Don Winslow's book. And you are attached to that? I mean,
Scott Frank and I have been working away on a draft of it. Yeah. I'm not writing off anything. All these things are possible. Yes.
And you also said that that each movie teaches you something to take into the next. So what did Logan teach you going into Le Mans 66?
Well, Logan taught me, if anything, a confidence that my own taste can sell. I really had my seatbelts fastened for a wholesale rejection by fans, given, I mean, not only did we challenge the kind of normalized Marvel tone completely, top to bottom, and not only did we leave threads hanging and not even deal with our connections to the, quote, universe, but I took, for good measure in writing the script, a couple shots at the comic world. And out of love, I love those movies as well, but I felt, you know, I inhabit the character that I'm writing about when I work on a film. And in the case of Logan, I think it's the ultimate craziness when fans are like, why isn't he wearing his uniform? A guy like Logan would never wear a fucking uniform. He hates being a superhero. Why would he be walking around with like a trademarked outfit on? It doesn't make any sense. I'm trying to make this character real. And this guy doesn't like being famous. He doesn't like being a superhero. By what logic would he, in the morning, after a coffee and a bathroom trip, go to putting on a trademarked outfit with a logo on it for the team he is part of? But all that angst on my end got out in the movie, and in a weird way, got enjoyed the good nature it was being offered in, but also in the reality we were creating.
Well, that line in the script, which was put out there, the CG city destroying fuckathon, has now passed into legend. That is,
well, it is what we feared, and what I even found that the pressure on me when I was making Wolverine, well, there's this kind of logic about the action and how often the action should occur and how big the action should be, and everything's gotten very programmed. And I think that one of my great regrets is to the degree that sometimes the Twitterverse and the hardcore fans of these medium actually play into the way they've been marginalized. People think they need to be fed certain things to be happy. And then when they aren't fed them, the audience does go nuts, and it proves the marketeers right that they've achieved a formula, and we just have to keep making this Soylent Green and everyone will be happy. And that I really think The reason we love comic books, those of us that love comic books, I'm not talking about comic book movies, but comic books, was that the Jack Kirby's made things anew.
Yeah.
They didn't draw last year's Silver Surfer. They didn't draw last year's Fan Four. They didn't. Superman was reinvented seven times to the point where they had to create a golden and a platinum and whatever universes they had to account for all these reinventions and remakings. That filmmakers are bound to this kind of idea of a fastidious connection to one another only reduces us to making episodes in the world's most expensive television show, as opposed to really exploring cinematically what can be done. And it, to any degree, Marty's recent comments that made the headlines,
in Empire
I think
Magazine.
Refer more to that. I think making a generalization about all Marvel movies or all any movies is extremely dangerous because there's great shit happening at Marvel. There's great filmmakers working for them. There's great filmmakers working on Star Wars universes and other sequels and originals, all sorts of stuff. But whenever we get into an assumption and a feeling you get sometimes from some of these films that they're more about selling you on the next movie than the one you're currently watching or on a kind of product line, or that's where I start to detach and start to wonder whether it's, quote, cinema or just marketing on the most galactic scale.
Well, weirdly, that's where I think some of the attempts to ape the Marvel model have fallen down because of that, because it's been so nakedly about setting up a universe.
You have to have a story to tell. You have to have a story to tell. And also what I think Kevin Feige and Marvel have been really smart about is that in most cases, they don't see, I don't think, the superhero film as a genre.
No.
They make a comedy, or they'll make us a kind of a Bridge Over the River Kwai, or a kind of the last, you know, they'll make a war picture, or they'll make a, you know, a kind of force, kind of Guns of Navarone picture, or they'll make a comedic heist movie. But in each case, I think they assign, just like we did with Logan as a Western kind of noir, you assign a kind of genre to your film and then allow these well-known characters to exist and explore that genre, as opposed to assuming the genre itself is just create a big villain, hire a famous British person to play them, give them a costume that doesn't look like the last movie and will please the fans, have everyone reassemble, slightly tweak the outfits so that magazines like yours can do stories on the, quote, new look, and on, but it's like, the real fun in those films that came from Guardians or came from Ant-Man or some of the great moments in the Avengers movies is where the films embraced their kind of roots in war movies and Hercules pictures and heist movies, and the lineage goes back further than 6 years.
Yeah.
Yeah,
James Mangold, we could talk to you all day, but sadly you're being snatched away from us. But it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Once again. My pleasure, guys.
Thank
always,
you so much.
Always look forward to seeing you when the next mystery project reveals itself.
All right, time for reviews, which are this week brought to you by the letter L and the person Adam Driver. So let's let loose with the L's first. Let's talk, in fact, about Le Mans 66.
Okay, let's do it. This is, as you have said, James Mangold's film about Le Mans, the 24-hour race in, yes, you guessed it, 1966.
Hey.
Then I just throw this shit together. So this stars Matt Damon as Carroll Shelby, the famous car designer behind the Shelby Mustang, among other things. Mm-hmm. And driver Ken Miles, the time played by Christian Bale, who's a sort of a volatile car driver who's enlisted here to take Ford up against Ferrari, which at the time was unthinkable because Enzo Ferrari essentially dominated that race in the Le Mans 24 Hour in 1966.
Yeah. What's hilarious in this story, by the way, you'll already have got it from there, is that Ford is the plucky underdog and Ferrari is the behemoth in that scenario.
Yeah. Before Madness. They got bought by Fiat. Spoiler. So this is an interesting one. I really wasn't sure whether I was going to like this film because I'm not a big fan of racing. A 24-hour race just is my idea of living hell. And yet, this is really compelling. And it's character-led. Like Ken Miles, Bale is brilliant as Miles.
Yeah.
He's volatile. His arc is fascinating about how he gets screwed over by Ford and you know, how he approaches it all. He's a really interesting kind of person who's, well, got his own demons to deal with, but also is one hell of a driver.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think Matt Damon does a really good job as a sort of charismatic car designer who's also trying to navigate managing Miles, but then managing upward to the head of Ford. And then you've got Josh Lucas as a Leo Beebe, who's the kind of Ford's number two, who, if I have to say, of every character in this film, he's the one that didn't work for me, because he's almost sort of a sort of cut-out corporate goon. And I felt, I'd be interested to see how close to reality his storyline is, because that felt like Hollywood embellishment to me. But I very much enjoyed this. It's not a short film. This is 2.5 hours long, which in some ways makes a certain amount of sense, because much as it is an endurance race, the film is also a bit of an endurance race. And by the end of it, you feel a lot like you've been driving for 24 hours. But even though it is long, it is also very good.
It is really good. It's a lot of men in rooms talking.
There's also a lot of men in cars driving. So there's both.
There is, but weird. Like, I don't care about car races. Like, I'll tell you that night. And I find this film fascinating anyway, because it is a lot about corporate culture. It is a lot about bureaucracy.
And if that doesn't float your boat, what will?
No, but in an interesting way, like, it's looking at all these different forces that kind of collide and get in the way of themselves.
Yeah. So it's not just man in car versus other drivers. It's man in car versus corporate overlords, versus company politics, versus all these sort of little elements. And even down to the fact that they have a problem with the car that the brakes keep overheating. And then it's the legal wranglers of whether or not it's technically within the rulebook to remove the whole brake assembly mid-race. That doesn't sound very interesting, but actually, really, in the context of the film, it's really good.
And also, you should know that this film has a habit of cutting very regularly to John Bernthal's Lee Iacocca, who's another car legend, just having reaction shots. He has so many reaction shots in the film. He's like dressed like Don Draper, has reaction shots every 5 minutes. It's amazing.
But what's brilliant about this, their head of marketing is the fucking Punisher. But he's also built like the fucking Punisher. So their head of marketing looked like he could literally tear anyone's head off while he's sitting there sort of gurning at them. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it. I thought it was fun. I love John Bernthal. And frankly, I think he should be in everything.
He should. So, genuinely. Yeah, I had this conversation online with Hannah Woodhead. We were literally saying this should be a condition of your film being up for Oscars, is that you have at least 5 minutes worth of John Bernthal reaction shots spread throughout the film.
I completely agree. I had a lot of fun with this. Me and Helen, we actually watched this at 8 a.m.
We did, that's
and,
right.
And, you know, anytime you're fully engrossed in the movie at that time of the day, you know that it's working. And I was really fully into it. Yeah. And the bromance between Bale and Damon's characters is great. At one point, they fight, and it's just the wife was played by
Katrina Balfe.
It's a bit frustrating for her, actually, because she doesn't get much to do.
She doesn't, which is disappointing. She's obviously, people will know her from Outlander.
Right. But she, in that scene, she's just watching them. It's a very, very funny scene. I really enjoyed it. It's a little predictable, but I was really into it from the get-go. I really enjoyed it.
He puts on, I have to say, Bale does an excellent Brummie accent. He sounds a lot like a Peaky Blinder for most of this, which I think some people were thrown by. But it's a lot of fun, even if it is, like the race, unnecessarily long.
That's possibly true. And we gave it 4 stars, which is a very strong recommendation.
Agree.
Sticking with the letter L, let's talk about our other director interview this week, Last Christmas.
So yeah, Last Christmas, Emilia Clarke plays Kate, who works a job as an elf in a London store owned by Michelle Yeoh. And
whose name is literally Santa.
Whose name is Santa, yeah. I like that touch. Yeah, and as we mentioned, she's in a downward spiral, but then she meets Henry Golding, and that brightens up her life.
I mean, that's fair.
Yes.
I think we can all agree with that.
I had fun with this one. It's forgettable fun, but fun all the same. I think Clarke and Golding are very charming together, and Clarke is really likable in this movie. She has to sort of carry most of it on her shoulders, and she does that very, very well. Golding does a Bond impression at one point in the movie. That's not going to do anything to quieten down those rumors. And I, one thing, would like to see Golding as next Bond once Craig is done in the role. I liked Emma Thompson, who also wrote the movie.
Yes.
She's very funny as Kate's Yugoslavian mother. And the movie also has a few things to say about Brexit, which was initially jarring to me, but they circle back to it a couple of times and it ends up being quite effective.
I agree with 10% of what you just said, which is my damning with faint praise, in that Emma Thompson wrote it and she's great. And I had so much goodwill going into this because I love Love Actually. So I have a soft spot for, let's be honest, shit Christmas movies.
With Emma Thompson.
Yeah. And I love Emma Thompson. So anything she writes, you think it's got to be great. The problem with this is it hits all the schmaltzy notes that something like Love Actually does. But while she is awesome on every level, she isn't Richard Curtis. And it's not, the writing for this just wasn't up to it for me. Also, and this is where I'm also going to disagree with you, Henry Golding was fucking terrible.
Oh, what? No,
absolutely terrible at this. Not entirely by his own fault, because his character is incredibly bland and two-dimensional and, quite frankly, a little bit annoying and quite condescending. So I think he's problematic.
I think he's underserved. I don't agree that he's condescending, because I think that is character, actually.
She's like, I'm homeless. He's like, well, here's a homeless shelter that I volunteer at. You're like, how is that helpful, Henry?
Well, no, I think there's a little bit of almost tough love there, which is weird. I think it's more a film about her getting her shit together than it is about the romance.
I agree.
I think that's why some of the romantic scenes feel off.
But did you not think, and I genuinely cannot remember a quote-unquote romantic movie where the leads have had so little chemistry as to almost repel each other when they're on screen?
I didn't feel that at all.
Me neither.
Oh, I shuddered. I was like, if there was close to a kissing scene, I'd be like, ooh, it feels weirdly like in their vibe was so not romantic. There was so little chemistry. I was like, this looks like watching a brother kiss a sister.
It's just wrong with you. You love Star Wars.
And so. I just didn't feel the Golding love at all. And his Bond bit in it is cringeworthy. I was like, well, if you ever were going to be Bond, it's not going to happen now.
Oh my goodness.
And the one thing I will say for this is I thought Emilia Clarke is this film's saving grace in
that
she is so charming and so likable. And even though sometimes she doesn't have that much to work with, no offense, Emma Thompson, because some of the bits in this, there are moments in this genuinely funny. So I think it's not like this is all miss for me. It's hit and miss. There's great stuff in this and there's less good stuff in this. But I think Clark elevates the stuff that she has.
That's the bit of good. Yay.
Yeah, I think she's really good. And I think, weirdly, like she's fallen into an unfortunate rut where she was great in Game of Thrones and most of the other things she's done have been poor. Mm. And people are starting to think, oh, maybe that was it for her. Maybe she can only do Daenerys Targaryen. But in this, I think, do you know what? She has chops as a comedy actor and I can see her getting great roles off the back of this. The thing with this film really is, see it for two things. See it for Emma Thompson, because her character's great, and see it for Michelle Yeoh, who is literally the best thing.
Oh my God,
this.
And her wardrobe. I mean, it's incredible.
And her one-liners. Like, all look like Thompson writes brilliant one-liners for Yeoh, and Yeoh delivers them perfectly. And I think the subplot, all of the Yeoh subplot, is genius. And when, and I won't talk about it in detail, but when Yeoh gets into the reason why she's called Santa, that was my favourite riff in the entire film.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So there is stuff to like in this, but I found there's a lot of stuff to hate in this as well. And all of it is Henry Golding. Sorry, Henry.
Wow.
I'm sure you're awesome, but not in this.
So 3 stars then for Last Christmas,
uh-huh,
which is a recommendation, James. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You absolutely.
That third star is a gift.
Okay, let's take a zombie break and let's talk about Little Monsters, which is a new Australian film which stars Lupita Nyong'o as a kindergarten teacher who takes her kids on a class outing. She's lovely. She's wearing a fabulous yellow dress. She takes them on a lovely outing. She has her ukulele with her. All is right in the world. They're going to a petting zoo at a farm. And then a zombie outbreak happens. So, what did we think of Little Monsters?
I enjoyed it, but...
Oh!
But, there's a but. So, Alexander England plays Dave, and he's another character who's trying to get his shit together. And he has a nephew who he's trying to help out. And he...
He's really gone on the class trip to try and get with the teacher.
And he is a character who, for me, doesn't deserve what he gets by the end of the movie. And that was an issue for me. But I still did enjoy this movie. I think the Taylor Swift to the tie-ins are really, really funny. I had a lot of her songs in my head by the end of the movie. And I would recommend it. But with caveats.
I think it's really cute. I mean, you're right. So Dave's character is awful and he's fixed on Miss Caroline. So I think you're meant to see a sort of love interest developing there. But really, he's nowhere near her league. She is incredible. We should also mention Josh Gad is in this. He plays a sort of kids TV presenter who's Teddy McGiggle, I believe is his name.
Great
character name. Terrible human being.
Yep.
It's a zombie movie. I leave it to your imagination what might happen to terrible human beings in this movie. But it is really inventive. I have not seen a zombie movie that focused on tiny children before, and I very much enjoyed that. And I very much enjoyed the fact that Lupita Nyong'o's Miss Caroline acts like a teacher throughout. She keeps counting them to make sure everybody's there. She keeps everybody's spirits up. She worries about juice boxes and, you know, snacks and toilet breaks and things like that. She's just adorable and also formidable, and it's a heck of a mix. So I did really enjoy this. It's very funny. It's a very funny zombie movie, although there is a lot of blood and gore as well. We gave this 4 stars. It's a good week, isn't it?
It's a good week.
So that wraps up the portion brought to you by the letter L. Let's talk to you about the portion brought up by the actor Adam Driver. And we'll do the report first because I feel like we're going to have much more to say about Marriage Story. So the report is the story of a Senate staffer, a US Senate staffer, Daniel Jones, who's played by Driver, who is set by Dianne Feinstein, the Californian senator, who's played by Annette Bening, to investigate the use of torture or enhanced interrogation by the CIA in the aftermath of 9/11. So he spends years on this report, only to find that it threatens never to be released once he's finished. Comes to us from Scott Z. Burns. What did we think of this one?
I really liked it. Mm. I think the second half is much better than the first half. And I think it's partially because the beginning of the movie, it starts off with the people who are charging Adam Driver's character to do this. You have to remain sort of emotionally sort of neutral. You can't sort of get emotionally involved that way. And then sort of, you know, unsurprisingly, by the time the second act rolls around, he's very much emotionally involved. Mm. Once that happens, the movie gets a lot more interesting. And Adam Driver is incapable of giving a bad performance. And once that emotion really starts to kick in, I really became invested in it. And the second half was really great.
Yeah, I think it's good at showing that gradual development as well. It shows him going from, you know, he's passionate about the law, he's passionate about doing the right thing, but he's not particularly engaged in this topic above all others until the time goes on, and then this gigantic report that he's compiled threatens never to be seen.
The first half is a bit of an exposition dump, we should say, as well.
I mean, it has to be. It's just a film about people talking. You could say the same about Le Mans, I think. I feel like this is another, you know, film that's all about people in rooms talking. But again, they're incredible people playing interesting roles, so you're kind of willing to allow it. But yeah, I think, again, Adam Driver is phenomenal. I feel like this is the film that's going to get lost in the shuffle this week. But even if you don't get to see it now, do look out for it. It is a really heavy, hardcore look at a horrific episode in American history, and indeed, you know, Britain's implicated as well in terms of extraordinary rendition and stuff like that. But it's a really, really fascinating film and a really kind of rigorous feeling look at its subject matter. So we also gave that one 4 stars. What a freaking week. Oh my God. And it's only going to get better because now we come to the other Adam Driver movie of the week, Marriage Story. From Noah Baumbach, Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver play a couple, Nicole and Charlie, an actress and a director, who are married and who are breaking up.
It's marital bliss in movie form, isn't it? Makes you feel good about your relationship.
Do you know what it genuinely, weirdly does give you a weird sense of hope for love? I find this ultimately very life-affirming. In a very strange way that I can't entirely explain. But I think it's an extraordinary film. This is a really even-handed look at both people in the marriage. And both are decent people. Both are trying to do their best for their young son. Both are also trying to do the right thing for them. So the issue is that Nicole's been offered a job in LA. She's going to take this job in LA. The first time she's maybe made a decision entirely for herself in the 10 years of the marriage. Charlie is still based in New York. That's where his theater company is, that he is devoted to, where his career is. And yet they have this son. Where does the son live? Who does the son live with? How do they balance this life? Can they do it amicably and without any lawyers involved? Or is it necessary to get other people involved in some way? And what will be the implications if they do? So it's dealing with some, I think it's fair to say, enormous issues, right?
Yeah. Now, I thought this was incredible. And yeah, you said it's very even-handed. Initially, when I came out of the movie, I thought it was slightly sort of skewed towards ScarJo's character. But the more I think about it, the more I think you're right. It's very fairly even-handed. That's a tricky balance to get right. But Noah Baumbach does. The performances are just out of this world.
Unbelievable.
And, you know, I mean, for all of Joker's faults, I decline to mention, I'm also not a fan of the Joker. But Joaquin Phoenix in that film is great. But at the same time, if Adam Driver does not win Best Actor after this, I don't know what we're doing, because he is on another supernatural level in this movie. On top of everything else that we know he can do very well. And I can apparently sing very well. which is just unfair almost. But he is great. Scarlett Johansson is great. It's just messy and raw and human in all the right ways. And I was just devastated by it. It's my second favorite movie currently of 2019.
It's very high up in my top 10 as well. I think it's an extraordinary film. There are also other great performances. We should mention Laura Dern does turn up as a divorce lawyer that Scarlett Johansson consults. Adam Driver's character ends up talking to lawyers played by Ray Liotta and Alan Alda. And they are both amazing, amazing characters as well. There isn't a bum note in this film, I have to say. It is just one of the best things, but it's also funny. It's sad, it's funny, it's warm, it's terrifying, it's upsetting, it's loving, it's hating, it's just the
and
business.
On top of everything else, it's got a great Randy Newman score too. It's one of the easiest 5-star ratings I will ever give a movie.
Which is what we did. We gave it 5 stars, and that is a heck of a recommendation. So for those keeping score at home, we have Last Christmas on 3 stars, which is a recommendation. We have Little Monsters, The Report, and Le Mans 66, all on 4 stars, and we have Marriage Story on 5 stars. If you don't go to the cinema this week, there is something wrong with you, with the best will in the world. Get out there and see stuff. And what a week. I mean, Adam Driver must be exhausted. I don't think we will see him in another big film for a long time, you know? 2 films in a week? Oh, he must be home for the duration, wouldn't you say, James?
I would think so, yes.
Yeah, he won't be back in cinemas within a month.
No, yeah. There's no Adam Driver films I can think of coming out anytime soon.
No, I think that's it. So anyway, great week for cinema. Yes, Marty? Hope you're listening. So do please get out there and enjoy it. No, just on a sort of personal podcast note, we should say that we're actually bidding a fond farewell this week to our producer, Jane, who's been with us over the last year. She's moving on to pastures greener and hopefully a lot less chaotic than we are and considerably more professional.
I would never voluntarily inflict us on anyone. I just think it's just cruel and unusual punishment.
Yes, it is. But Jane Long, it's been absolutely a pleasure having you. You'll find her work on other great podcasts like Girls on Film. So yes, other more professional and polished productions, and she will be missed here. So thank you very much. And that is it then for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we will hopefully have Chris back from his lurgy, assuming he hasn't died of man flu. And we'll also be joined by some people from Frozen 2. Which people in particular?
Did they want to build a snowman, Helen? That's the question.
Well, it would be going into the unknown to
into
say
the
who.
Unknown.
For the first time in forever, we have frozen people on the podcast.
But no, I believe it is Jonathan Groff and Josh Gad. So they should be absolutely.
Now, do you think he'll be in sort of like happy-go-lucky Christoph mode? Or do you think he'll be in really, really serious Mindhunter mode?
I think he'll be...
Or a really terrifying blend of the two.
Or completely flamboyant King George III mode. Or nerdy Seymour from Little Shop of Horrors, which he's currently starring in mode.
Well, I just remember when I went to D23, they did one of the ensemble Frozen 2 songs on stage. I was like, that is Holden from Mindhunter. I've literally just watched him talking to Charles Manson on Netflix, and this is freaking me the fuck out.
Well, let's find out by tuning in next week to the Empire Podcast. Until then, it's goodbye from Amon.
Peace.
Goodbye from James.
McClunky. And while I've got you here, do not forget to download the Pilot TV podcast, where this week we will be reviewing some TV shows. But more importantly, I am making Terry watch an episode of Farscape.
No.
Yes.
Why?
Well, actually, this is the second. We made her watch one and she didn't like it. And so I'm refusing to admit defeat, so I'm making her watch another one.
Well, this can only go well for you.
Yeah. It's going to be entertaining.
Okay. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to pitch the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences the idea that every single film to be nominated for an Oscar should contain at least 5 minutes worth of John Bernthal reaction shots. I think it's a no-brainer. So
agreed.
We'll find out. Second. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.